And it is today's topical occurrence. Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman. How are you this afternoon, Bonnie?
I'm doing good. Looking forward to talking with Augustine.
Certainly an interesting man.
Yes.
Well, this hour we begin with author Augustine Burroughs. His latest book is This Is How, Surviving What You Think You Can't. Somehow We Get By. Augustine Burroughs joins us from New York City. Welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Hi, Augustine. Pleasure to have you with us today.
Thank you.
Three of the strongest messages in your book are to find the truth underlying the truth, to live in this moment, and to focus on the present, not to be a victim of one's past. Do you still struggle in any of those areas today?
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, I came to those realizations by, of course, doing exactly the opposite.
Right.
You know, spending a great deal of my adolescence just being furious at my father or, you know, various injustices that I felt, you know, had been inflicted upon me, you know, so I was a victim. And it, you know, I was very angry as a teenager. And, you know, I grew up, I mean, I talked about this in Running with Scissors. You know, my mother was mentally ill and couldn't raise me, and she gave me away as a child to her psychiatrist, who was very untraditional. He eventually lost his license to practice medicine. But I was raised in an environment without school, and where there was no adult in my world that was sane or reasonable to whom I could go for advice. So whenever I had a problem or an issue, I had to figure it out myself. And that's really the origin of the book. I mean, after all these years, it's just that I'm someone who I tend to fix myself. And, you know, if my brain is broken in a certain area, I do tend to, you know, tinker at it until I find a solution. So, you know, these are still things that I think I struggle with and everybody struggles with, but to a much lesser extent than I ever did.
Right.
What's broken right now?
What's broken right now, you know, it's what it really is. There are certain things in my life that I don't pay them the mind that they deserve. You know, I've never been financially responsible in terms of, like, you know, saving money or, you know, value. I'm just bad with money. I'm bad with it. And I'm not organized, you know, in terms of my scheduling of things. And those are the reason for that is just because I just don't do it. You know, it's not that there's anything I need to get over there. It's just I don't do it because I'm doing other things. And, you know, part of it comes down to, as well, learning to tell, you know, part of being honest with yourself is learning to sort of tell the difference between what you want and what you just really wish you wanted. I mean, I have a friend who, you know, she's been on a diet for as long as I've known her, you know, many, 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 many years. And if you're on a diet after 20 years, you know, and it's just not failed, that's when you have to ask yourself, is it that it really matters to you to be, you know, quote unquote thin, or is it that you wish it really mattered, you know? And the answer can sometimes be infuriating because a person may really, really want to be something, you know? They may really want and wish to want to be thin, but not actually enough and not more than whatever it is that they enjoy that, you know, is blocking the way to thin. I mean, maybe people like cheese or cupcakes or whatever it is. And just realizing that about yourself is tremendously freeing. But again, like I said, it's not like you have that epiphany one day and you feel free and, you know, stress free, because you can have to face something in yourself that you may wish were in fact, you know, not the case. But if it is, it is.
You spend a great deal of time in your book on food addictions on both sides of the issue, and your methods for dealing with the addictions are rather novel and pretty unorthodox. Tell us about some of them, like your prescription if you had an anorexic child. I found that really interesting and kind of fascinating what you would have done.
Well, you know, I was actually not going to write about eating disorders, anorexia. You know, I don't have it and I don't have kids, so I sort of felt like, well, who am I to talk about this?
Right.
But it was, I have friends who are impacted by this disease. And, you know, when I finally put it down and decided, you know what, I'm just not going to write about it, the moment I sort of released myself from that thought, well, I knew exactly what I would do if I had a child or a daughter or son who had an eating disorder and, you know, the therapies had not helped. I knew what I would do. And I have to sort of, before I explain what it is I would do, I have to say that, you know, there needs to be a lot more research in this area. And what I put in the book, I threw out there into the world, hoping someone would research it, because the current therapies, food journals, these things don't work. And I couldn't find any research anywhere in my studies to, all the sort of treatment programs have food journals and, you know, a lot of very sort of group therapy, but I can't find a single sort of ground zero source that justifies that treatment. I think what it is that I think anorexia is a spectrum disorder. I think it's related to autism. I think it's a hypersensitivity to the perception of control. So if push came to shove and I had there was no cure, there's no successful treatment, I would give my child a credit card and I would, with their college tuition on it, and I would say, go. You're going to make every decision. You're on your own. I don't want to hear what's happening. And it would be horrible to do that, and I would feel like a monster. But here's the reason I would do it. If you told me you were going to kill yourself today, and you knew it, tonight you were going to do it, and then I gave you a magic sleeping pill that knocked you out for 18 hours, and I put you on a flight to India or Sri Lanka, and you woke up, I don't believe you would kill yourself that night, because as soon as you got off the plane, there would be so much overstimulation, colors you'd never seen before, smells, you know, where do you find a restroom? Why does the restroom look so different? And I think you'd be so overloaded that you just have to get your bearings. And that's not to say that the next night you wouldn't remain suicidal or the night after that. But if you can buy one little window, you know, you can pry that window open. And I think that, you know, a great deal of anorexia is connected, obviously, to control and a feeling of lack of control.
Right.
So what if you gave someone too much control, all the control?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not saying that's necessarily the thing to do.
Right.
But I think it's definitely the thing to research.
We're speaking with Augustine Burroughs about his book, This Is How, Surviving What You Can't, What You Think You Can't. Twitter at
Topical Currents.
Augustine, you talk quite a bit about suicide in the book. Tell us of your thoughts and attempts, and you say it doesn't really bring peace.
Well, no, because peace, as well as joy and regret and comfort, these are all emotions that require neural activity to experience. You have to be alive to feel peace. And I was struggling with suicide. I had decided to kill myself as a young teenager because I felt that, you know, there was no way that I would ever have a chance to live a normal life given my living situation, my circumstances. But when I sort of deeply, deeply thought it through, I realized that the act, the method that I had chosen was not going to certainly provide any relief. It was going to be, you know, painful, involving a knife, and this was going to be very, very shocking. I've never seen blood like that before. So the brain, being wired for novel, which is to say new, unseen, original stimulation, if I'm in a bathtub and I slip my wrists, all of a sudden there's crimson water, that's going to be stunning. I'm not just going to pass out. I'm going to be alarmed, and that's going to make my blood, my heart pump, and the blood flow faster and faster, and I realized that I would just be adding this layer of sort of gore and horror to the depression. I mean, here's the thing. If the act of suicide, if the swallowing of the pill or the tightening of the noose, if these things did provide relief or peace, a sense of relief or peace, everyone would stop midway, because the body is just genetically designed. We are created to live and to fight to live. It's difficult, you know. It's difficult to end one's life. Your body fights against you. And that's when I realized something that I think a lot of people don't realize, that it's not that I wanted to kill myself. It was that I wanted to end my life. And there's a huge difference, because I never really realized before that I could step out of this life. I mean, I grew up in this town. My mother was ill, my father, and this was her psychiatrist, and these were his kids and patients, and this whole world in which I lived, it was tiny. I mean, it felt big, and it felt like, well, this, you know, our life is what we know. Our life is the world, but in fact, it's not. It's tiny, tiny, tiny. And I realized I could step out the door barefoot if I had to. And instead of making a right, I could make a left. I could get on a bus. I could get on a container ship. It didn't matter where. And would my life be better? Maybe. Maybe it would be worse. Maybe it would be similar. Maybe it would be the same. But I would be alive. So the difference is ending one's life versus killing oneself. And that's a distinction. It sounds like semantics, but it's not. It's a very, very profound distinction that people really need to be made aware of. You know, when we talk about kids who are suicidal in the media, I just again and again and again, I hear exactly the same advice. If you have a child or you know a child who's suicidal, please encourage them to talk to someone they can trust, a figure, you know, from their church or someone from school that they trust. But that's very bad advice because it just passes the buck. What is this person going to say that you don't know what to say? I mean, no one really knows what to say to kids who want to kill themselves, you know? And right. We just sort of pass the buck around and hope that someone with an advanced degree knows what to say. And I think the thing to say is when you think about it, suicide isn't going to work because you're not going to be alive to feel that peace. And all the anger you feel, you're not going to be alive to watch the suffering of those you left behind. I mean, that's a terrible thing to say, but part of the motivation in some people for killing themselves is revenge, is to hurt people that they feel have hurt them. And, you know, certainly it's not terribly noble, it's understandable, but you're not going to have that either. I mean, there will be whatever discomfort created by your method of choice for suicide, whether it's sort of, you know, upset or pain in the stomach or physical wounds or, you know, whatever, asphyxiation, there's going to be that layered on top of the despair or anger or misery that you felt that brought you to that stage. And then literally that's the end. That's it. You don't exist in the world. The world has gone on. You are, that's it. So it's a myth. We romanticize suicide, you know, and people say, oh, well, she looked so peaceful in the coffin. Actually, though, not. People don't look peaceful when they're dead. They look gone. They look like meat, you know. That's not peaceful. They don't look like they're sleeping. So, yeah, that was an important thing for me to write about. I mean, it's not a funny topic, of course, you know, and I'm known for funny stuff, but I just felt this after writing so many books about myself and having a lot of them be very funny. I just felt like I've been so deeply moved by the, you know, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people I've met over the years as an author. I've been so touched. It's made me more human, and I just can't stand the idea of people, you know, struggling with some of the things that I have struggled with that I don't struggle with now. And especially when I know, look, this is how you need to think about it, or at least this, when I thought about it this way, it freed me from it. So that was really sort of also the inspiration behind, you know, putting the book out there in the first place.
And you researched the area of self-help before writing your book and didn't like much what you found. Was it wanting to share these things, your compassion for others, that motivated you to write the book?
You know, I did. I researched, you know, specifically confidence, because one of the things that I've been told again and again when after, you know, like I'm speaking at a college or at an event, young people frequently will come up to me and talk about how confident I am. And, you know, that's something that I've heard since I was a teenager when I got into advertising, you know, very, very young as a teenager. And I had no problem at all standing up in front of the board of director of Coca-Cola and, you know, talking to them about whatever it was I wanted to do. And I guess that's confidence, right? Apparently I have it, and I had it then, and I had a lot of it. So I've studied myself, you know, on my mental laboratory tray. What is it, this thing that I have? You know, people want more confidence. So I read about sort of how authors, self-help authors specifically, position confidence. How do they sell it, you know, to the world? And then, you know, usually there's 3 to 7 steps. Part of it is, you know, admitting the things you're good at and reminding yourself of your successes. And I just thought, that's terrible, because that's completely false. People are wasting their money. You know, confidence, you can't go to the doctor and get your blood confidence level checked. You know, it's this thing you want more of. Well, first you have to define it. What is it? I mean, the fact is, speaking as a confident person, there is no thing in me that's extra. I don't have this confidence fluid. You know, there is no such thing. Confidence is a word that exists in the observer. And it's a word that's used to describe a certain quality that one observes in another person. And that quality is a focus of the moment. The person is being themselves, doing the thing that they're actually doing in the moment that they're doing it. I mean, years ago when Steven Jobs introduced, I think it was the iPhone to the world, maybe the iPad, but the iPhone, I think, when he introduced it to the world, it didn't work. It just, like, he pushed a button and it didn't work. A little malfunction. He made a joke, and everyone laughed, and everyone loved him, and everyone bought the phone. But imagine if he'd stepped outside the moment and thought, because, you know, making a joke in a situation like that is what you would do if you were home alone. But imagine if you sort of stepped outside what you were doing and thought about them. How does this look? Oh, no, what are the shareholders going to say? We've spent so much money on R&D, and if this product is now failing in front of a mass audience, this is terrible. You know, you've departed the moment. Confidence is gone. There's no such thing. Confidence is really, to get more confidence, you need to care a great deal less about what other people are thinking. You have to not let your mind travel outside of the moment, specifically the thing you're doing in the moment. And you literally have to not worry about it. You have to not think about it. You have to stop yourself. You have to block yourself from asking, do I look confident? Do I look good doing this? Because, you know, confidence has nothing to do with competence. You can be terrible at something and still be very confident when you're doing it. So those were, you know, some of the sort of fallacies that I saw in the world of, you know, self-improvement that I thought, well, this needs to stop. I mean, it's ridiculous for someone to spend money on a book when confidence is a thing that you can easily, you know, achieve the thing people call confidence. You can practice it. You can really practice not letting yourself wonder what they're thinking. Wonder how you look.
You give a good example. I mean, I loved your little thing about what you did to start the ball rolling on not caring what other people thought. Yeah, really. But sometimes we have to care what other people think. Like such in a job. What about for those who have to care?
Well, it's not about not caring what someone thinks. It's about, I mean, because you don't want to, you know, it's not to confuse it with sort of a lack of empathy or a lack of understanding. If you've been hired in a job to do a certain thing, that's what you need to be focused on. Not whether they think you're doing it well or not, but doing the thing that you're paid to do as good as you can without the interruption and distraction of wondering if you're doing okay. You've got to sort of have faith that if you're not, someone's going to tell you. You know, someone's going to say something.
Right.
So it's not that you're not listening to people. It's that you're not wondering if they're judging you.
Mm-hmm.
They're not. You know, if you're a waiter or a waitress and you plop down, you know, the order. You know, you can't stand there and think about, well, am I doing this, you know, did I get this on time enough? Do you think they're going to tip me enough? You know, all those distracting out of self thoughts, those mm-hmm. have nothing to do with reality. And, you know, so it's about not thinking other people's thoughts, you know, for
right.
them, not inserting your head into theirs. But absolutely listening to other people. In fact, it's essential to listen to other people because when someone is speaking to you, it can be very easy to think you know what they're saying and to start immediately going, yeah, yeah, uh-huh, and waiting to insert your question or, you know, comment or, you know, your mind drifts. But when you actually listen, you know, you lose yourself. So that it's, you have to really kind of be in your interactions on a daily basis. You've really got to be fresh, like fresh homemade bread every second of the day. I mean, that's the goal, you know, that's the goal.
Augustine Burroughs, you changed your name at age 18.
Mm-hmm.
Why Augustine Burroughs?
Well, I did change it at 18 because I didn't want to be, I was born Chris Robeson, and I didn't want to have the name. I wanted to be a different person. I didn't want to be the person who had gone through, you know, the experience with my alcoholic father and mentally ill mother and growing up in this crazy environment, I wanted to start over. I wanted completely to have a new life. And, you know, I was 18, so it seemed like, well, changing my name, I'll just reinvent myself. And, you know, for the newness of it, it certainly, you know, was fun. And it did help. But, of course, you know, all the things I was running away from, you can't ever run away from. You know, they run right after you. And if they see you running, they'll just run faster. So I ended up, you know, with this name. And why Augustine? You know, it just, Burroughs was an old family name. And Augustine sounded sort of classic, but unfamiliar.
Kind of Roman.
You think you've heard it, but not quite. It's a little more modern because it's not Augustine, it's Augustine. So it was, it just, I liked it, you know. And then my middle name is X-O-N. And, you know, I was studying computer programming at the time, and back then, I don't know if it's still the same, but computers used to be either X on or X off, and X on meant you were in a state of accepting input, and I thought, what a perfect middle name, like a fulcrum, you know, always accepting input. So that's the story.
Augustine, you seem pretty ambivalent. I know you've had a lot of therapy, but in the book, you seem ambivalent about the value of therapy and therapists. I've guessed there are some good ones, some bad ones. Where do you stand on that now?
Well, I do. I think that, you know, I mean, there are good ones and there are bad ones. I think a good therapist, you know, is going to be someone who is completely professional. You don't want to be friends with your therapist. You don't want to be pals with your therapist. A therapist, a really excellent therapist, you know, has training, first of all, but they are good at pattern recognition, and they can identify or observe patterns in your behavior that you're not aware of, and they can point those out to you, and, you know, they can sort of show you or point you away from going down sort of psychological dead ends. But people need to be aware that therapy is a business. It's a business just like any other business. And any smart, successful business person wants to have a lot their customers come back again and again and again and again. So the therapy sort of treatment modality is not set up in mind with speed, you know, necessarily, or even efficacy in mind. It's you know, a commitment to one's self. But that's ad speak, really. I mean, that's ad speak. And it of course, it's also like ad speak. In many cases, it's also true. It is a commitment to oneself. So, you know, I think it depends on, you know, if it's something that you enjoy and you're actually experiencing progress, then there's no reason, you know, if you can afford it, not to remain in therapy for, you know, a long time if it's useful to you. But, you know, it's not necessary. It's not always necessary. And I think there are some things for which therapy is absolutely necessary. I mean, anger is one example, because anger is something that people, you know, it's a very frightening emotion. And, you know, it is an emotion just like every other. It's not, you know, something abnormal, and it's not something that's a flaw. People feel anger for, you know, a biological reason. But because we repress it as a culture, it can come out in explosive and deadly ways. So I've always felt that, you know, if you've got anger issues, you definitely want to be sitting across from somebody in a white jacket with a clipboard because it's scary, you know. But for things, you know, there's a lot of things that people can get over themselves. And, you know, even in therapy, really, you are the one doing the work. You know, and a therapist should be reminding you that at all times. So it's not that I'm against therapy. It's that I think you need to have someone who's very good at it. You know, sometimes people enter the field of therapy because they themselves suffer from psychological issues that they want to understand, you know, and they're crazy and they want to figure themselves out.
Exactly.
And there's no way to actually identify, you know, which person is which. So you need to find recommendations from people that, you know, you think pretty much to the best of their ability, have it together. If you've got a friend who seems to, you know, sure, they have problems and such, but they also, you know, they work on them and they get through things, and you see their life has progress, that's someone you'd want to ask if, you know, they have a recommendation.
Well, I guess we're just about out of time, Augustine Burroughs. One thing you say truth is an opinion. It's a force of it's not an opinion. It's a force like gravity. And I found it to be the bedrock of your book. And you say it's how we survive the unthinkable. And we want to thank you so much for joining us today. And good luck with the book.
Thank you. I appreciate you having me.
Okay. Thank you. And welcome back to today's to today's Topical Currents. Bonnie Berman with you. Joseph Cooper is away. Well, blogging is popular. Food blogging is huge. Let's find out why. Joining us now is chef, author, syndicated columnist, and cordon bleu chef, Linda Gassenheimer. Good afternoon, Linda.
And our friend. All right.
Linda, do you have a blog?
Well, yes, it's part of my web page, but it's not exactly. Let's find out from the expert here.
Okay.
Because have you ever heard of Blog Her?
I have now.
Yeah, Blog Her and Blog Her Food.
Is that as opposed to Blog Him?
We'll find out.
Okay.
So are you confused by blogging in general? It's really become part of our lives. In fact, there's going to be a Blog Her Food Conference right here in Miami next week. And here to help us understand more is Blog Her co-founder and COO, Elisa Kammerhort. Welcome, Elisa.
Hi, Linda. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you with us. You're going to have to really help Bonnie and myself and probably a lot of other people understand a few things. And so we'd love to hear from you, our listeners. Do you have any blogging questions for Elisa Kammerhort? Give us a call. That's 800-743-9576, 800-743-WLRN.
And email is radio@WLRN.org, or you can tweet us at Topical Currents.
Great. And of course, with us, our favorite wine guy, Fred Tasker. He's joining us by Skype. Fred gives the wine suggestions for my Dinner Minutes column that you can read in today's Miami Herald. You can also read Fred Tasker's wine column in today's Herald. Fred, what are we drinking? Are we blogging drinking?
Absolutely. One of my favorite topics is wine blogs.
All right. Okay. Great. Elisa Kammerhort, first of all, what is Blog Her?
Well, Blog Her is the largest community and network of mostly women who blog but also use all the other social media platforms and through that have become influencers to their audience.
Why only women? I mean, you said mostly women, so I suppose you may have some non-women.
Yes, otherwise known
called,
as men.
They're called men, Linda.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
We were founded almost 10 years ago, and our mission is to create opportunities for women online to pursue education, exposure, community, and economic empowerment. And we were really founded because women comprise more than half the population, more than half the internet users. They are more than half the active users of tools like Pinterest and Facebook, Twitter. And we wanted to shine a spotlight on what they're doing online and help them get paid for their work.
Well, that's an interesting point. Get paid for their work. There's so many bloggers out there, and monetizing a blog is just so difficult. So how do you help them?
Well, we have a couple of different ways people make money working with Blog Her. I mean, first of all, we pay the writers whose work we syndicate on blogher.com. So we
Let me ask you. You syndicate some bloggers?
Bloggers.
Right. So on blogher.com, it's really a news service and community hub about everything women are talking about online. So we have some on-staff contributing editors, but we also syndicate work and commission work from bloggers all over our community. And if we publish you on our site, we're going to pay you for that work. So we believe that you should be paid for the writing that you're doing. But also, we work with thousands of influencers to help them monetize by participating either in running our advertising, so we work as their publisher, basically, or they participate in various kinds of promotional and marketing campaigns.
Well, I want to back up a little bit.
Yeah.
You work with influencers. So tell me, what is that?
Well, so, the world has changed a lot in the last few years. And back when we started, blogging was really it. But now, of course, you have Pinterest, you have Twitter, you have Instagram, you have Facebook. And people are building audience and building community. And our research shows that when someone trusts the person they know online, they consider them a real friend, and they consider their recommendations as valid and trustworthy as any other real friend, and more valid and trustworthy than things they read from people they don't know. So we really consider those people to be heavily influential consumers themselves who just happen to speak to millions of other consumers. I mean, our network reaches 100 million people a month, so it's a big
deal.
And you have advertisers, Elisa? That's how you function?
Yep, we have advertisers. We have sponsors for our conferences. We have marketers who do content marketing campaigns with us. And for us, one measure of our success is how well are we serving the people in our network on that mission of creating economic empowerment. And over the last 5 years, we've paid $36 million to almost 6,000 members of our network.
Wow.
Yeah, so we're really proud of that. That's one of the ways that we really measure our success as a company.
So so let me try to understand. This is getting a little difficult. Bonnie and I are sitting here with frowns on. But so you have to join Blogger. That's the first step. Is that right?
To monetize, you have to be in our network and apply to be in our network. To be syndicated as a writer, you submit. You submit to be or solicit to be syndicated like you would any other publication or media outlet.
When you say apply to be in your network, how does one do that?
Well, you can go to blogger.com/advertising, and there's a whole, we have a set of criteria. One of the things we're really dedicated to is not really the size of your audience, it's the quality and consistency of your content. You can have a smaller audience, but they trust you 100%, and therefore you are extremely influential with that audience. And so we're much more concerned about quality and consistency and the willingness to sign on for our editorial guidelines, which means you moderate your comments, you make sure that there's no unacceptable content, you're not plagiarizing, you're properly attributing and not violating any copyright, that you're all sorts of guidelines.
So you vet, in other words, the people
exactly.
who are applying. And is there a fee to become part of your network?
Nope. It's free to join, and then we share revenue with you on the advertising, and we pay you directly on a retainer basis for any content marketing program that we may involve you in.
Well, sounds good.
Sounds very interesting. We probably have a lot of listeners here who are not even sure what a blog means. So tell us a little bit about blogging in general.
So blogging has been around for a long time, and a lot of times when people ask me
when you say a long time, you mean what, 5 years?
Oh, no. Blogging started in the late 90s, mostly.
Okay. All right.
But it became more of a commercial force in the mid-2000s, and we were one of the early ones who were helping people figure out a business model for blogging. But the thing about blogging is a blog is just a kind of website. There are as many different kinds of blogs as there are different kinds of websites. People blog about every topic under the sun. There's many different visual formats. I mean, we've even kind of broken away from blogs used to be pretty much reverse chronological order and very simple in navigation. But now there's just, there's blogs that look like beautiful magazine sites, and there's blogs that look a lot of different ways. So you don't even always know when you're looking at a blog versus any other kind of website.
As to whether or not it's a blog or a website.
Yeah,
and
it's hard to distinguish.
So, but many websites are, in fact, blogs.
Right. So I don't think it's that important to distinguish, actually. It's about who's the content creator and do you enjoy the content. I think the thing that may distinguish blogs is that there's always authentic, recognizable, identifiable humans that are speaking on blogs. It's not a corporate site that has a corporate voice. It's not a site that sort of just has the editors and you don't know who they are. It's very human.
So if I'm looking for a subject, I want to grill vegetables, okay?
Uh-huh.
So what do I do? Just type in bloggers who talk about vegetables? I mean, how do I find the blog? Because there's so many hundreds of them out there.
Right. So, that's the interesting thing about blogs is that they actually do very well in search results if you're just going to Google or Bing something. Blogs will typically come very high in the results because they're very search friendly and there's lots of dynamic content and they're very link friendly. They're always linking to one another. But what brings a blog up in search results is how many people have shared that link, how many people are pointing to that link. And so oftentimes if you blog, how to grill vegetables, your first page is going to have a healthy amount of blogs in it. But you can even, Google even has a specific blog search tool, or you can go on blogger.com and search as well.
And search that way. I noticed you mentioned in some of your information, Linky Love. So is this what you're talking about, linking? Tell us a little bit more about linking and Linky Love.
So if you go back to the beginning of the blogosphere, one of the fundamental parts of blogging and sort of the ethos of blogging was about reciprocating and giving each other what we call link love. And you always attributed, you always gave credit, you always were pointing to other people. And part of that is the way you build community, because when you point to someone, they see that you did that, and they're like, who linked to me? That's so nice. Let me check them out. And now you're building relationships.
So how do you do that? Well, you're talking to novices here.
Yes. Well, in most blogging platforms, they have what's called, I'll give you a fun tech term, WYSIWYG, which is an acronym that stands for what you see is what you get.
WYSIWYG, okay.
WYSIWYG. And yes. it's an interface for blogging that looks like your word processor. It looks like Microsoft Word. And you're typing, that's what you're typing in, and you hit publish and you're done. Well, just like you can do in Word, you can attach a hyperlink or a URL to another site underneath words that you're typing. So you highlight them and you insert the link. So when it goes live, you can say, as I learned from Chef David Leibovitz, and his name will be highlighted, and someone can click on that and go to his website.
His link.
Right.
His link, right.
Okay, yeah.
So it's a big value in the blogosphere to always share that link love. And when you're talking about someone and you're linking to them, A, so they know you're talking about them, and B, so they get a little link love.
Okay. Well, now you're coming to Miami for a BlogHer conference. So
yes.
Tell us when and where.
So we're going to be in Miami next week, May 16th and 17th, Friday and Saturday, at the Hilton downtown Miami for BlogHer Food. And BlogHer Food is the largest conference focused on food bloggers and online food photographers and writers and stylists and chefs and authors that exists in the country.
Now, the blogosphere is so huge. Why did you just pick BlogHer Food? Is food one of the largest types of blogs out there?
It is. So we have an annual conference that's the largest conference for bloggers in the country, and that's this summer in San Jose, and that's going to host 4,000 people. But we noticed that food bloggers were becoming a bigger and bigger part of it, and that their content needs, their learning needs were really intense. Food blogging is serious business. I mean, if you think about it, if you're a recipe blogger, you need to come up with the recipe, then you create it, then you cook it, then you style it, then you take pretty photos of it, then you have to write a great story about it, and now you're sharing it and promoting it. There's a lot of steps. And so we knew that this was a great place to pull out and focus. It's also a huge traffic driver on the internet. People, you know, food is universal. Everybody's got to eat, and everybody's got to figure out what to eat. So it drives a lot of web traffic. It drives a lot of searching. And that's why food blogs have been able to become, they're our largest topic area, and they are for a lot of other media companies, too. It really drives a lot of web conversation and web traffic. And so wow. It was a natural fit to pull out and do BlogHer Food.
Well, I'm Linda Gassenheimer. My guest today is BlogHer co-founder and COO Elisa Kammerhardt. We're going to take a short break here, and we'll be back with more blogging information. We'll be right back. We're back. I'm Linda Gassenheimer. BlogHer co-founder and COO Elisa Kammerhardt has been navigating us through the blogosphere. And Bonnie and I are very, very trying very hard to navigate with her. She's been explaining how BlogHer works, how some bloggers are monetizing their blogs, and what's going to be happening at the BlogHer Food Conference here in Miami, May 16th and 17th. And if you'd like to join it or know more about that, go to BlogHer.com. I think it's BlogHer.com/food. Is that right, Elisa?
It's BlogHer.com/conferences.
Okay, oh, say okay. It again.
BlogHer.com/conferences.
All right. So, well, if you want a dinner in minutes, let's talk about that for tonight. Or this is a no-fuss quick dinner for Mother's Day. So if your family wants to make a dinner quick and easy for Mom and you don't want to go out for dinner, this is a roasted chicken pasta salad, and the only cooking you're going to have to do is to boil up the water. And you can use any type of shortcut pasta for this. Buy a rotisserie or roasted chicken. Just cut it up into bite-sized pieces. Then I mix some mayonnaise and some curry powder with some mango chutney to mix that all together. Toss it with the chicken. Add the cooked pasta. I add a little sliced celery. And then I serve it over some romaine lettuce and tomato wedges and sprinkle scallions on top. So it's really simple. It's colorful. It's light. I think it's something Mother would like. And you don't have to mess up the kitchen, which you would like even more. That complete recipe and a photo, it's at dinnerinminutes.com. And if you want another really, really simple, even more simple recipe for Mother's Day, my recipe today is an antipasto salad, and it's in today's Miami Herald. And please follow me on Twitter. That's at L. Gassenheimer. So, Fred Tasker, what are we drinking? Or blogging
well,
drinking?
Well, if you have great food blogs, it stands to reason that they should be paired with great wine blogs. And there are a lot of them out there. I Googled the words wine blog, and I got 491 million hits.
Which million? Makes them million more, hits?
Million.
More popular than the Beatles. Anyway, one of my favorite blogs is by Alice Fearing, the wine and travel columnist for Time magazine. She spells her name F-I-E-R-I-N-G, but it should be spelled fearless, because if she disagrees with you about a wine, you really know it. She wrote about a French wine critic who had panned the Chenin Blanc white wines of his country's Loire Valley. She said, "He does not shy away from unsupported sensationalism. Now he has written an article that places him in the forefront of lunacy." So she calls him, that's telling it like it is.
It sure is.
She calls herself a radical, and I believe her. You can find her at alicefearing.com. And there's another wine blog by the British wine critic Jancis Robinson, and she is a real expert. She's co-author of the 700-page World Atlas of Wine, so she knows something about hundreds of wines. And she's so popular, she seems to be invited to every important wine tasting in the world. I was just reading one of her items about it, tasting half a dozen Bordeaux reds from the 1964 vintage. I mean, how many people could do that? You can really get into the depths of wine with her. She
Does
was
that
the
mean
first...
she drank it? She got a hold of a 1964?
Well, I mean, she was invited to a tasting.
Tasting, yes.
Yeah, by somebody who owned those wines. And you've got to be pretty important to get invited to something like that.
Okay, I'm sorry. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, she was the first person outside the wine industry to pass the really rigorous exam to become a master of wine, which involves identifying dozens of wines and blind tastings. And she said her secret was that she was pregnant at the time and she had to spit out every drop of wine she tasted. And this kept her palate sharper than her competitors, so she did better than they did. And she's at Jancis Robinson, that's J-A-N-C-I-S, Robinson.com. And then if you're a beer lover, there is a great website called yourbeernetwork.com that links you to 7 beer blogs. And in full disclosure, one of them is The Beer Clinic by The Beer Doctor, who is a prominent cancer doctor named Carol Westbrook, and she's my daughter's mother-in-law.
Okay.
And this week, just full disclosure, you know.
That's all right,
this,
Fred. Sounds
this week
good.
She has a very interesting entry about the up-and-coming Empire Michigan hops farm run by my brother-in-law. So see how well-connected I am. And it means that if you're a real wine or beer fan, you could spend your whole life browsing these blogs. And in some cases, I kind of do. And I hope you have a glass of wine or beer in your hand at the same time.
You know, Fred, I'm just kind of picturing your family Thanksgiving, beer drinkers versus your wine drinking. I mean, you know, I hope you get along.
Well, up in Michigan, I'm living in northern Michigan now, and the local beers are better than the local wines in a lot of cases. So I'm becoming a beer fan.
All right. Sounds good to me. Let's go. Lisa Kamahort, do you do any, does Blogger have a lot of wine bloggers?
Well, I will say that the majority of our food bloggers are definitely baking and cooking, and especially special diets are really popular now, you know, food allergies, gluten-free, vegan. But we have a few wine bloggers as well. You have to have that to go along with any great meal.
Okay, sounds good. Now, if somebody just wants to start blogging, what advice can you give them?
Well, besides coming to blog her food next week in Miami, the best advice I give usually is to start by reading blogs and get a sense of what you like and what you don't like and what appeals to you. And think about what do you really want to talk about consistently for a while, because I think a trap a lot of people fall in is that they start a blog and it's all over the place, or they started on a topic that actually 3 months later they're like, ugh, I can't talk about this every week anymore. So really think about what you're passionate about And the third thing I would say is that you don't have to share your blog right away. You can start a blog using one of the low or no-cost tools like Blogger, WordPress, Typepad, and you can start writing just for you and get a sense of what you want to talk about in your voice. And then when you have some content there, then you can let your friends and family know and start to get some engagement and feedback. I think the pressure of having everyone come visit you when you have one post saying, hi, I want to start a blog, I think that's tough.
Alisa, what's the average?
You know, I'm wondering if you feel that you have to post something new every day if you have a blog. I did a blog when I was at the Herald, and it took up half my day. It really is a time user.
I don't believe you have to blog every day. There are no rules. First of all, most people blog for self-expression, and so that means you make the rules. Now, if you want to make money, yes, blogging more frequently, more consistently, and more high quality will help you do that. But first and foremost, figure out what you want to talk about and stick to and will enjoy. And that's sort of the first step before you go on and figure out more, I think.
What's the average length of a blog? I mean, how long should it be, if there is a should?
You mean the length of posts?
Yeah.
I think that most people probably, if they're going to have an actual story they're telling, you're looking at 400 or 500 words, you know, something okay. That's similar to a column in a newspaper is a good guideline. I used to write a column for a local weekly here about being a vegetarian and a vegan, and, you know, I had a 300-word column, and that's pretty analogous to a post. Now, you can really wax poetic and go on, or you can do short posts as well that just say, hey, I saw this cool thing. I think you guys would like it too. Check it out. Here's why.
Okay, so let me ask you, how do you know when people are creating their own recipe or they're just taking somebody else's recipe and not giving them the credit?
Well, you know, that's a tough problem for food bloggers. They get they have to really keep an eagle eye. And, you know, you can't really copyright. There's a whole we often have sessions at our conference, in fact, about the legal ramifications, because there's a lot about a recipe you can't copyright. You know, there's a million recipes out there for how to make this or that item. It's tough.
Yeah, right. Well, we're almost out of time, but I just wanted to make a note to South Florida chefs. The Australian Lamb Spring Fling Chefs Contest is on, and the grand prize is a trip to Australia. So, chefs, to enter, you have to create a lamb dish, and you have to send it in, and you have a short deadline. The deadline's May 9th. So send your recipes to australianmeat.com/springfling. And it's been a very interesting week. Alisa Kamhort, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Nice to meet you.
And good thank luck you. On the Blogger Food Conference in Miami, May 16th and 17th. And for more information, go to
blogger.com/conferences.
That's correct. Thank you, Bonnie.
Thank you, Bonnie. Next week will be our popular restaurant roundabout. It's a one-hour program with reviewers Jen Koretnik, Matthew Meltzer, and tips from you, our listeners. I'm Linda Gassenheimer. Join us then.
Bye, Fred.
Bye.
Bye.
And that wraps up today's Topical Currents. It was our pleasure to have you with us. Our producer is Richard Ives, with technical direction from Michael Stock. Our online producer is Paul Leary. We have free audio archives and downloads from our website, WLRN.org. More information and links to the Topical Currents Facebook page. That's facebook.com/topicalcurrents. And you can follow me on Twitter at Bonnie Berman. Tomorrow at this time, please join Ed Bell for another edition of South Florida Arts Beat. And we return on Monday with a look at collaborative law and the training process with Florida Collaborative Trainers. Bonnie Berman wishing you a great Thursday, a great weekend, and a beautiful Mother's Day. Don't forget, you can still get your flowers for Mom through WLRN for your $120 contribution. Just 5 hours left to do that. 1-866-247-9576. 1-866-247-9576. WLRNradio.org. Stay tuned for Here and Now, up next from NPR News.